I'm Rob Dietz.
I'm Jason Bradford.
And I'm Asher Miller. Welcome to Crazy Town, where Sammy Hagar's I Can't Drive 55 has replaced the national anthem.
Hey, this is Crazy Town producer Melody Allison. Thanks for listening. Here in Season 6, we're exploring escape routes, pathways that just might get us out of Crazy Town. In today's episode, Jason, Rob, and Asher are escaping speedism. And here's a quick warning. Sometimes this podcast uses swear words.
Language!
If you like what you're hearing, please let some friends know about Crazy Town. Now, on to the show.
Guys, I decided I'm into role-playing.
Nice.
All right.
And
a little scared.
And I decided I'm going to role-play as Rob today.
Ooh, I'm right here.
Yeah.
I'm over here.
No, you're going to be Jason today.
Oh, no.
And Jason, you're going to be me. Okay? No. I just, the reason I brought it up, the reason I said that is because I wanted to not run a quiz by you, but just to kind of gauge where we're all at in terms of a very important question.
All right.
Which is, what is the worst or most implausible car jumping scene in cinematic history?
Okay.
I get the channeling me now. This is right up my alley.
And I decided that I would do a little bit of homework. So I scanned. I didn't do every decade of cinematic history, but I went for like last four decades. So I went back to the 80s, 90s. Wow. 2000s and the 2010s.
You really put some time into this episode.
Hey, man, I work hard for this show.
Yeah,
I prep.
That is all fantastic, the research.
So,
what you got? Lay them on
us.
I'm
going to put in front of you
four
scenes.
Okay, and we'll watch them and then we'll come back.
So we're going to start with the iconic Blues Brothers film from 1980.
Yeah.
All right.
Then we're going to go to the classic Speed from 1994.
Oh,
Keanu Reeves.
Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock, mm-hmm. Then we're going to go into the franchise that is the Die Hard franchise.
Okay? Oh,
But we're going to
Bruce Willis.
The 2007 Live Free or Die Hard.
Okay.
And then we're going to another franchise, an even longer running franchise, mm-hmm. the Fast and Furious franchise, which, Rob, I know you watch every single one of them. You own them all in your DVD collection.
I can't name any of the actors in this one because it's too new.
Come on, Vin Diesel.
Everybody knows
that. Thank
you. No, I don't.
Well, the thing is, I was never a Fast and Furious fan, amazingly. I don't know why. I just decided not to.
Well,
but
the way you love cars. I mean,
is it sad that the other three you named, I don't have to go watch the clips. I already know.
Which
the scenes
talking about.
In the...
All right, so we're going to play them. Blues Brothers, Speed, Live Free or Die Hard, Fast and Furious 7. Okay, here we go. All right, guys. So, what you got? Which one, if you were to rank these...
Yeah. So, like implausibility
I'm
from laws of physics?
I'm talking about implausibility, yeah.
Well, I think that's an obvious. For me, it's the Blues Brothers. But that's because they meant it to be.
Yeah.
Like that they were playing upon the implausibility.
Yeah.
And so they made it implausible and it's hysterically implausible.
That's the problem here is there's a difference between implausibility from a actual physics standpoint and implausibility from a suspend disbelief.
Right.
Yes.
Like if I'm watching a ridiculous comedy slapstick, I expect cars to maybe not obey physics.
Right.
But
cars to fall from higher than the Sears Tower.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. But before we go any further, I'm a little sad that there's nothing in here from the Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, but that's a film.
I know. Well, they did make a movie.
I mean, it's Speed, there's the bus popped a wheelie. That was ridiculous.
Right. So this is what prompted this whole thing in the first place. Like I would say, based upon what you guys were just laying out, which is it's not so much just a physics implausibility from a physics standpoint.
Yeah.
It's like in the context of the plot.
Uh-huh.
And I would say that Speed actually was like, we have to make this work. We have to make this sort of seem believable. And because of that, it is even less believable to me.
Well, the thing with Speed, I remember the movie coming out and everybody was really high on it. This is a great movie. They got the perfect setup for suspense. The bus has to stay above 50 miles an hour. And I remember losing all believability when the bus hits the end of the highway because there's no ramp. Like the bus, somehow it angles up.
Yeah. It jumps
up. It jumps across this
wheelie.
Huge...
It's like trying to dunk.
Yeah,
basically.
it goes across an Evel Knievel chasm.
It's got great calves.
But if you were actually to film that, a bus, it would just plummet.
Just fall straight down.
Yes.
Well, so look, we're not here to do movie criticism. I mean, there are probably better podcasts for that. But the reason I brought it up, because we're doing escape routes this season, and the topic of today's episode is escaping speedism. And so, of course, you'll forgive me, I thought of that film.
I mean, the other ones may be breaking the laws of physics also.
Yeah.
But the speed is just so obvious. It's the worst in terms of its obviousness of breaking. Okay?
Yeah.
But the others are terrible as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
But getting on to the idea of speed.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole episode, as you said, it's about speedism, right? And the problem that things are going too fast. Seems like all of modern society is stuck on that bus with Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves. It's like we are addicted. We have to keep going that pace.
And we are imagining implausible scenarios by which we can actually survive.
Keep going.
Yes. Right. The bus has to pop
a
wheelie.
We can jump the bridge, basically. Yeah. That's right. Okay, let's get into speedism, right? What are we talking about here? Now, there's been a lot of advances in transportation technology, right? And I think that they have led big time to the speed of life changing. Just think about how long it takes to get from point A to point B before cars and highways existed, right? Or even before trains. Mm. Just a completely different...
Yes, different world.
Different world altogether. So again, I did my research.
Thank you.
I went deep into the wells of the internet.
Yes.
I was thinking, like, how long did it take John Adams, for example, to go from Boston to Philadelphia, you know, for the...
Right. For our Australian listeners, that is one of the founding fathers of America, you know, authors of Declaration of Independence, Constitutional.
Our second president.
I love how you point out the Australian listeners.
Well, listeners are from Australia now, so I have to basically keep them along.
And I don't know if this guy's a relative of his, but there's another Adams, too, who's arguably much more important.
Yeah.
Samuel Adams, because he, you know, is the great famous brewer.
Yes.
Right? And we now have Samuel Adams.
The beer.
The beer, which is more important.
Hopefully we export
resin.
It to Australia, I'm hoping.
Well, they got their own stuff, Foster's.
Yes, Foster's. Yeah.
In any case, so, you know, how long did it take the Adams to travel, you know, to go to the Continental Congress, let's say, in 1776? So I was looking at his blogger post from back then.
Yeah. I thought you would just recreate ride.
Yeah, I should have done that. Yeah. It's kind of hard to read with his, like, ink. But in any case, it probably took between 10 and 15 days. You
that's
know?
20 to 30 that's miles about, a day.
Yeah, it's like 300 miles of a journey, you know, for, again, for our foreign listeners, about 480 so kilometers. Mm-hmm. You know, so 10, 15 days. If you were to do it now, let's say, and we have to factor for traffic, right? Let's say there wasn't traffic. You know, it'd take you less than 7 hours by train.
Yep.
It would take you less than 5 hours by car. And it would take you about 90 minutes by plane.
Yeah.
I mean, shit. Our transportation infrastructure sucks. I mean, if you were like in Japan or China or you know, even in Europe, you know, taking a bullet train, you could probably slash the time. You know,
so a few minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And what Elon is working on with the vacuum tubes.
Yes.
You could be there in like 2 seconds.
Yes.
You know, but
even with a bike today, you could probably do it in 3 days.
Because we have the nice, smooth
good roads,
tarmacs.
Good paths. Yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
So when people think about speed, typically Americans think about speed, they do think about moving in like cars, for example, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the way transportation has changed has had a remarkable impact.
Well, then also, of course, that impacts trade. So that all leads to the way life has been transformed because of our ability to get stuff from other parts of the world.
Yeah.
So, for example, tea was very important to our forefathers. We're not as important nowadays, but you know
they didn't like it. They dumped it in the harbor.
You know, so kind of we turned our back on tea, but
just for a little bit.
Yeah. But anyway, if we stick to the tea theme, on the Silk Road from China to Rome, right? They would move tea across that.
Yeah.
It would take six months.
Wait. Wouldn't they move silk across that?
Well, they
did. They did all kinds of
all
goods.
Kinds of goods. Okay. Yeah, silk and tea.
It's not named the tea road.
They wrap tea in silk.
Yes. Okay.
Sorry.
It doesn't matter. All kinds of stuff. Silk, you know, tea, whatever. Jeez Louise. People I have to work with. So now it only takes about a week to get tea that far. So vast improvement.
Yeah.
And the thing that gets me, of course, that I think about when I go to the market. And you can get like fresh blueberries all year round because they're finding them all over the world. They're going to Chile and they're going, you know.
And they're sticking them on a plane or like fresh fish that gets, you know, overnighted to sushi restaurants or whatever in Denver.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. You know, think about trade. This is a completely different form of trade. But think about like high frequency trading.
Yes.
Right. If you think about speed of trade.
Right.
And we're talking about what's happened with the trading of stocks.
Right.
Right? The stock market. High frequency trading is insane.
Well, computers are doing this, yeah. Right? Like so nanoseconds of stuff.
Yeah. What high frequency trading basically is computer trading done with proprietary algorithms done by computers, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're trading commodities, you're trading currencies, for example, mm-hmm. you're looking for changes to happen in the value of something mm-hmm. and you're jumping on as quickly as possible. In some cases, they're actually changing the outcomes. But according to the NASDAQ, fully half of all stock market trades are in the form of these computer-generated high-frequency trades. So there's just all this shit going on constantly, and these people are looking for little marginal edges based yeah. upon nanoseconds, in a sense.
Yes.
That's about, I don't know, maybe there's a faster way of doing it, but that's kind of taking it all the way to yes. to the extreme, right?
Well, and I think you're making the turn to the speed of information, because you talked about the speed of people, then Jason, you're talking about the speed of goods.
Yes. So
and yeah, and now you're talking about the speed
silk
of
silk and only silk.
Yeah. Right, let's finish. This podcast is no longer about speed; it's about silk. you're talking about the speed of these transactions. Well, that's all about the information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I was thinking about the news. You know, when we were kids, you'd get a daily newspaper, yes. maybe.
You know, right, delivered. You might even have a route.
Yeah,
you might
have maybe a route. It was wrapped in silk.
Yeah.
That was only the Wall Street Journal. You had to pay a premium.
I remember listening to you could hear it hit the door sometimes. Yeah. The guy would throw it.
Oh, kid. Yeah. Yeah, they'd try to, like.
Mine was not good. He would just crash right through the window.
There was that video game, Paperboy. You remember that?
No.
Where you were the Paperboy and you try to throw the newspaper yeah. into houses.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. The kids these days have no idea what we're talking about.
They're like, what is this game?
Yeah.
What is a paper?
But then think about it. You go from that. There was also nightly news on the
sure.
TV.
Sure.
You know, you'd have
Walter
a
Cronkite.
Half hour show, whatever.
Yeah.
But then you got the 24-hour news cycle, like yeah. CNN and, yeah. and cable channels, yeah. and those started multiplying.
Ted Turner kind yeah. of started that.
And then now you got streaming, right? Mm-hmm. And you've got this just instantaneous worldwide spread of news. So you're getting information at a rate that you never had before, and more information, and it's kind of dizzying.
You're just talking about in our lifetimes, right? And we're ancient. But if you go further back, like, I mean, it's really hard to imagine. People didn't know who won the presidency
right,
for
right.
weeks sometimes.
And then the telegraph machine was so huge because
yeah.
you could at least get stuff yeah. across the country fast or across the Atlantic.
We're talking about weeks or months to get information.
Yeah. And I mean, we tend to focus on the downsides of these things as, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of
no,
our shtick.
No, I don't think that's our shtick.
But I do just want to point out there is some upside to this kind of speed. Like oftentimes, I think about in the past when I wanted to learn how to do something, I might have to go down to the library, check out books
sure.
and get it all wrong, get another book.
Right.
I might have to hire a coach or some kind of teacher or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now you could jump on YouTube and
yes.
get 12 tutorials on whatever it is that you want to do. So,
oh, sure. You want a better tennis forehand? Just go on YouTube and...
Well, look, this podcast wouldn't exist if it wasn't for speed. I mean, think about the speed of the internet and being able to transmit energy.
Yeah.
Just even with the internet age, if we're back in the days of like... dial-up, 28 point
yeah.
whatever it was,
yeah.
people having to download. First of all, their hard drive wasn't big enough to download an 80 megabyte file.
Right.
You know, like one of our podcasts. But it would take them all day to download that puppy.
Yeah.
You know? And then be like, this
And we
sucks.
Had to listen to this.
This is not worth it.
Right. All my bandwidth for this.
Yeah. So the only reason people bother to listen to us is because they could download it so fast.
Now, I also think of like the speed of fight scenes in movies has also gone up. You notice that?
Oh, really? Yeah. Like yeah. Back to our buddy Keanu Reeves, like
yeah.
the John Wick
oh, right.
stuff. Those
right.
are some fast fights.
Unbelievable. I mean, Jackie Chan, of course, I think pioneered a lot of this stuff, but it's much more choreographed and complex. But I think, you know, all kidding aside, the speed of which we are able to kill people has gone up with technology. You know, it used to be what was that movie 300 or whatever? I
yeah.
keep the movie.
Yeah, the Spartans.
The Spartans. You know, right. they had swords and stuff, and now you start shooting people. And you have machine guns, and now you can like launch a hypersonic missile and destroy a whole city. So
yeah.
much more efficient.
Yeah, violence has sped
yeah,
up.
Yeah, the speed of violence. That's great.
Yeah, sorry about this.
We're talking about the upsides here, right? We're just right. sticking with it.
Well, let's get back to the downs. Let's get back to what we're good at.
I think a key thing about this sort of speed stuff, or one thing to think about, is that it's not just that things are faster, right? And the benefits and the consequences of that, but it's also that if it wasn't for Speed, certain things wouldn't be possible. I mean, we just talked about the fact that no one would listen to our podcast. But back to the example of moving people, right? If it wasn't so relatively fast to get from, let's say, the United States over to continental Europe, people wouldn't do it. I mean, so there's that very famous documentary about the Griswold family, European Vacation.
Wonderful Americans.
Yes.
You are channeling me today.
Yeah, he is.
Good work.
They wouldn't have ever done that trip, right? I mean, you couldn't. Who could take out the months it would have taken, you know, to travel across the ocean?
And the poor Parisians never would have met the Griswolds.
I know.
I don't know, though.
Things that they're missing out on.
What about these people that are on the year-long cruise now? They're taking the time.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Well, I think you're actually making another turn here, which is to the idea of accelerationism, which is the first derivative of speedism.
I thought, what's
mathematically speaking.
Okay. I thought speed was the first derivative of acceleration.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know.
One way, you're integrating or taking derivatives.
We're doing something, though, mathematically.
That's a long time ago.
So brilliant.
We're putting a square in front of something.
The brilliance and just eruditeness of this conversation. Stunning.
But no, the idea is that it's not just that things are going faster, but all of this taken together is accelerating the entire pace of change for society. You can really see it over the last, say, 50 to 75 years. And, you know, you could have questions about when's the period of the greatest acceleration.
Right. They talk about doubling time, right? And that at each doubling, you've used as much of something as you have in all previous history. Right. It's just madness. So I think in my lifetime, you know, there's been at least a doubling, and in some cases, one and a half, whatever, doubling, which is a weird thing to think about, of oil use and all these things and plastic production. And that's just amazing to think about. So there's this great graphic. I think Will Steffen was his name, the and part of the Stockholm Resilience Center, and they produce these graphs on these socioeconomic and Earth system trends. And they're all these hockey stick graphs, right? Because when you have this acceleration, when you have this incredible growth, it all looks like in the near term it's just gone, you know, vertical on these graphs. So the hockey sticks of doom, they sort of look like. But some people, of course, GDP's on this graph, the hockey stick of GDP, or world population, or, you know, hydroelectric dams. Some consider that progress. But on the Earth systems, when we have CO2 in the atmosphere, or rate of extinction, these are terrible things to look at.
Yeah, so Will was an Australian scientist. Unfortunately, he passed away last year. And I think he was the one who coined the term the Great Acceleration. And if you look at these hockey stick graphs that you're talking about, trend lines that are environmental and social, and you just see this insane dynamic, you know, of all these things going straight to the roof. And it's interesting because obviously a lot of the changes, we've talked about this extensively, go back to the harnessing of fossil fuels, right? Which kind of uncorked everything for us. But there is sort of this dynamic, even in a nearer term, like you were saying, Rob, last 50, 75 years, it's a whole other level, know, of acceleration that's happening.
If you look at his graphics, like you said, Jason, there's the socioeconomic on one side and then the Earth system trends on the other side. And to me, it's the whole crazy town premise because, like you said, most people look at the left side, the socioeconomic, and they say that's progress.
Right.
You know, and that's what we're saying is, well, maybe it's progress in the very, very short term that cannot be sustained. And so we better find a different model. And it's crazy making to think our whole economic system is based on these hockey sticks of doom that are going to put us into extreme peril. When it's right there in front of your face, and people aren't paying attention, and they're misconstruing what kind of progress we actually have.
I think it's actually interesting because, you know, what you're pointing out effectively is the unsustainability of that progress, the consequences of those things, right? But there's a lot of arguments to be made and have been made, even just within the social sphere, that these things that we might view as progress actually come with a lot of social consequence. And there's a German sociologist and political scientist named Hartmann Rosa who developed this theory, what he called the theory of social acceleration. He's talked a lot about kind of the negative impacts of this dynamic. So His view, and I'm going to quote him here, is that society is modern if its mode of stabilization is dynamic. That is, if it needs progressive growth, acceleration, and innovation just to reproduce its social structure and to maintain its status quo. And what he's saying here is that in his view, it's a key component of modernity to have a society that kind of needs, we've talked about how societies need economic growth in order to function modern societies. But he's talking about sort of this dynamic of the growth of innovation, acceleration of social change, and all these things being kind of like required in order for a society to be stable at all, a modern society to be stable.
So in some ways, I think it sets up expectations, right? You expect my kid's generation is going to have it better than I am. And so you're willing to sacrifice in the near term thinking that, okay, well, I'm making a better world. And you see this often with, you know, economists will say stuff like, well, don't worry too much about solving today's problems or paying for today's problems. The future will be, wait, and we're going to be so much more advanced later. It will, it's just an incredible assumption, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I like that idea you said from Rosa that society's mode of stabilization is dynamic. You can add that right into the oxymorons, dynamic stabilization, right?
It's like if you put me on one of those like playground, what are those things you
like a merry-go-round?
On the playground, they had those ones. I don't know if they allow them anymore because they were so dangerous. Remember as a kid, though?
Yeah, you get thrown off of them all.
Yeah, you try to make it go faster and faster. Next thing you know, kids are flying off and crying.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of feels like those are the good old days. You hit the tan bark, you know?
Just rub some dirt in it.
Yeah, you get splinters.
It's your broken
nose. It was the speedism that got you. If you'd just gone at a sustainable speed, you wouldn't have been thrown off the merry-go-round.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so boring, Rob.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen a video of somebody taking their motorcycle, the back wheel, and putting that up against the merry-go-round so they could really fling it.
Yeah. That's the next level stuff. Yeah. Motorize the merry-go-rounds for the playground.
Right. So let's get into Rose's ideas here a little bit more. He talks about three types of social acceleration. And the first one is maybe the most obvious. That's technological acceleration. And we can all look at that. Like I said, last 50 to 75 years, you've seen a huge jump in technology. I think it's kind of interesting to think, was it a bigger jump in the 20th century, or has it been a bigger jump more during our lifetimes?
What about the 19th century? Well, remember we had this podcast.
We had a podcast in
the 19th century? Season 4 on
Watershed moments in history?
Yeah. Remember the whole thing on the world's fairs and how each world's fair really was unleashing a new set of technologies?
Yeah.
But we're talking like plate glass windows.
Yeah, the telephone.
Electricity.
Refrigeration.
Lighting.
Yeah.
The wheel.
So I almost feel like, the 19th century, it was just unbelievable stuff. And the 20th century, sure, we honed them and we got, better appliances. But anyway, we can argue about the qualitative changes that happened in the 19th and 20th centuries were incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I would say we probably, certainly with transportation, we've hit kind of the diminishing returns of technological advancements, right? We're not going much faster.
Yeah, cars.
Yeah, it really was once that wheel got perfected. Once they removed the last corner on that octagon or whatever it was.
I think they're going to bring back square wheels.
Yeah.
Just you wait. I think you're right. I think you could argue that the impact of technological change or acceleration of technological change 100, 200 years ago or whatever was maybe more dramatic in terms of changing day-to-day life. But the pace of life, it's dramatically different now.
Pace has gone up.
I think, way up.
Yeah.
And you're talking kind of like just the rhythm of day-to-day living or?
Well, so I'm going to quote a guy named Bart Zonfor who wrote something about Rosa's work. And I just thought it was a good way of kind of describing the pace of life thing. So bear with me. This is a bit of a quote here. So quote, the acceleration of the pace of life can be explained in terms of the following paradox. How is it possible that our lives seem to get or at least feel busier and busier despite the fact that technological change, which allows us to do more in less time, should leave us with more free time on our hands? The point of inventions like the washing machine, the car, and email seems to be that they should save us time, but the availability of cars has led us to live further away from work. And although writing and sending emails is faster than writing and sending letters, the volume of email sent and received has increased to such an extent that we spend more rather than less time on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a great way of kind of, I think people can all relate to that, right? Like the pace of life, even though we've had all these technological advances, has actually gone up arguably more than the benefits of the, of that technological change.
He actually also gives changes in fashion, for example, that accelerated. So typically, you know, you had an average of maybe 10 years, a fashion trend would last 10 years in the 20th century. And now, and we're talking, we're in the first quarter of the 21st century. And now with fast fashion, the trends are as short as 3 to 5 months. And younger generations are especially more caught up in this. And they also then, it's not just about fashion, but they end up changing relationships and jobs more often. They tend to be accepting of that, and their life tends to have turnover after turnover.
Well, we could see, on the social change way, which is the third of his three, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have technological acceleration, pace of life, and social change, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You could see that even just in terms of what's considered sort of like culturally appropriate or not appropriate, for example. Terminology. There's sort of a velocity of how these things are changing, it feels. And I think for some people, it could be bewildering. It's like, wait a second, now I'm supposed to be using this kind of terminology or that word, or that word's bad or whatever it is. And I'm not, you know, you could be agnostic about whether it's good or bad. It's just the pace of it can really feel dramatic for people.
Yeah, and I think same thing. There's some cases where that's clearly confusing or makes life tougher. There's cases where it can be good, like the Me Too movement and exposing a bunch of dastardly acts out there. Like that seemed like that all accelerated and hit a tipping point, which, you know, I would say was a very good thing. But that also gets to the idea of the positive feedback loop, which we've discussed back in our Hidden Drivers season, and how that affects all of this idea around accelerationism. You know, we've got those three forms: technological acceleration, pace of life, and social change, and they contribute to each other and build on one another. You know, like technological acceleration, of course, with all this technology, contributes to social change. I mean, the things that we're spending our time on is at least in part related to what's available to us.
Smartphones, for example.
Yeah, obviously. That's why we're sitting here in front of microphones doing a podcast that you couldn't have done 10 years ago or whatever.
Right, for people to listen to on their phones. Yeah, your point is they're feeding on each other, and the overall thing is accelerating faster and faster in terms of social acceleration. I mentioned this briefly, but I think it's worth pointing out that most of the acceleration I think that we're experiencing or seeing is actually not so much in the biophysical world.
Right. The washing machines aren't getting better. The cars aren't much faster. The planes aren't breaking the sound barrier.
What are you talking about? The cars can jump off of highway bridges and get across
cars
a huge chasm.
Buses can. Not cars.
That was
buses.
In the 90s. That
And we've talked about this before, too. If you think about Moore's Law, right? The doubling time of a computer chip's processing speed, which is an exponentially growing phenomenon, coupled with it, like the internet and all that, we're really seeing it actually in terms of information and the kind of impact that that is having. So even the fact that it feels to me, I'll just say, it feels to me like I'm able to get stupid plastic shit that I buy on Amazon faster than I would have been able to get it 5 years ago even.
Right.
And I do think that there has been quote unquote improvement in that, but that's probably not driven by the fact that the trucks that are transporting it are faster. It has to do with the efficiency gains that they have in terms of like all the informational systems.
Supply chain logistics have been incredible.
And probably the fact that we've got these huge corporations that have swallowed up so many of the marketplace that they could have warehousing all over the place. So it doesn't have to go as far as it had to before.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like, oh my God, everything's so much faster. A lot of that really is driven by computer technology, I think, in particular.
Now, there's really strong evidence this is really impacting us in some ways that I consider pretty negative. And we can measure these changes to what's happening to human beings and their minds. So a key one is attention spans. And Gloria Mark, a PhD professor of informatics at University of California, Irvine, studies the digital media and its impact on people's lives, and did an analysis of changing attention spans. And here's what Gloria said, quote, back in 2004, we found the average attention span on any screen to be 2.5 minutes on average. Throughout the years, it became shorter. So by around 2012, we found it to be 75 seconds. And then in the last 5-6 years, we found it to average about 47 seconds. And others have replicated this result within a few seconds. So that's just astonishing to me.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking within 20 years, attention span dropping from 2.5 minutes to less than a minute, 47 seconds.
So at this rate, like in 10 years, 3 seconds.
We'll be like goldfish, all of us.
Like that.
Yes.
In fact, I was going to ask you to TLDR what you were just saying because it was like right. taking too
Sorry,
long.
Sorry, yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, it tells me that our podcast is, you know, like 90 minutes too long. It should be about 47 seconds.
Yeah, if we can really... Well, they'll be implanting us with chips soon so that we can keep up.
I will say, I'm going to sound like such a boomer here, but a lot of younger people, students, they're consuming information that's online, right? And, you know, you can have professors assigning them to watch videos or even sometimes podcasts. We actually have PCI as some of our stuff out there that instructors are using. And it's not uncommon for students to be listening at 1.5 right. speed or 2 speed.
Yes, exactly.
Which I don't know if you've ever tried, but holy shit, like I can't keep up with it at all. But people are becoming conditioned
right.
to be able to, I'm skeptical about how much they're able to actually take in, but right. they are operating like that. Like, so not only is the information coming to them more quickly, they're consuming yes. it when they receive it even more quickly.
Yeah.
It's pretty nuts.
Yeah, this stuff is fascinating, the effects on the way that we deal in the world. And another person that's looking at this is Dr. Aoife McLaughlin, studies how do we perceive time. And McLaughlin found that people who are always online or working on their phone or whatever, they overestimate how much time passes. So if they're trying to figure out when an hour is up, they're off by 10 minutes. And
It's 50 minutes have gone by, but they think an hour has.
Yeah, it's like time, they just can't track it anymore.
Mm-hmm. And the time seems to be going faster for them then, it sounds like.
Yeah, and actually even people, they've done studies, like even people who don't use technology very much, if you put in front of them, like read this ad online or read this excerpt from a print book, mm-hmm. they feel like time went faster when they're reading the ad online. Hmm. So there's just something about the technology that's kind of changing people's perception of time. And you could see, like, in terms of thinking about sort of some of the social dynamics, right, of speedism or accelerationism, you know, the first thing I've thought about was actually kind of the dynamic with social media that I find so troubling, and even in the mainstream media, which is this sort of like rush to judgment, this pressure right. to be the first mover in a space. So like you've seen this, for example, with like the news media is wanting to call an election result before their competitors.
Yeah.
I think they've learned and try to correct for that because there have been mistakes in the past. Like, I don't know if you guys remember Bush Gore, right?
Right.
Like, they switched it a few times with that because they wanted to be the ones right. to be first. Now with social media, it's like somebody posts something and you need to be the first shit talker right. on there. You got to be the first one to like denounce them or attack them or give them, you know, plaudits or whatever it is, because there's like the social esteem that you get.
And there's no time to hear both sides or reflect or try and find context or nuance. And then by the time 20 minutes have gone by, a conclusion has been drawn and there's like everyone's piled on.
And you can't and how do you correct back out? The record,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It just becomes fixed even though it was like incomplete or whatever, right? So you see that in terms of kind of dynamics, in terms of how people are receiving information, reacting to it. You know, you have the whole like Facebook adage, move fast and break things. So sort of like corporate culture, particularly I would say coming from the technology sector, which is like, yeah, we got to move fast and it's okay to break shit. So what if we broke democracy?
Right.
You know, it's like, it's fine, right? And interestingly, I was thinking about this in terms of like the response to climate change, which is something that's near and dear to our hearts. And I have obviously huge sympathy for it, which is the more urgent the crisis becomes, the more sense that we have that we have to respond to it
right.
with speed, right?
Right?
And that means that might lead us to adopt solutions that maybe have really unintended consequences
right.
that maybe are not actually true solutions.
Maybe that don't even make sense in the first place.
Right. So there's a kind of this rush, you know, yeah. the sense that we've got to solve this problem. We got to get into it right away.
Now, I myself am like an extremely patient person and never get flustered or, you know, feel rushed. But I've noticed that other people have such over-the-top expectations sometimes for customer service. And, you know, of course, during the pandemic, there was like trouble with hiring and communicating staff and people were sick. But, you know, there some people get impatient now.
Yeah. Not you.
Not me.
Not you.
And then there's also the whole talk about how if you got a boss. Now, I don't have any.
No, you would not thrive under a boss.
No, I don't understand this. But apparently people who have a boss, the bosses expect them almost to be on all the time, right? Like the idea is you've got your phone. And so like the culture has shifted where everyone's present and everyone needs to be served now, right?
Particularly with white collar jobs, you know, that whole idea. Again, that's a combination of technology and an expectation of speed.
And I think because what we're getting is we're getting addicted to dopamine and it's becoming this short attention span and this cycle of, okay, I feel some tension. I want something. I got it. Got
to have it now.
And if you don't, you get anxious, right? So that's an addiction cycle, I think, that not only manifests then in all aspects of your life, in other words.
Yeah. An aspect that to me is really resonant and something that Rosa has written about, and maybe the reason he's really gotten into this question of social acceleration, really has to do with what the impact is on the broader society and culture. I mean, there are impacts on us as individuals that we're sort of talking about here. Mm-hmm. But you think about it writ large, what happens to society when things are accelerating so much? What is the impact in terms of our social ties and social connections? If people are feeling the sense of like, things are outside of my control.
Right.
And I do think that when I see the trend towards right-wing populism, for example, mm-hmm. that's happening across the world. As we're recording this, there's just an election in Indonesia, one of the largest countries in the world, where mm-hmm. they voted for a pretty right-wing authoritarian military dude.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of reasons why those things might be happening. There could be people's sense of being left behind economically. You know, mm-hmm. we talked about that with like globalization and neoliberalism, you know, so there's anger about being left behind from that standpoint. Maybe there's actual embedded things around sort of jingoism or xenophobia or whatever around mm-hmm. cultural change that's happening because of immigration or just the demographic changes that are happening.
The classic explanations you're giving us right now.
But I think that there is something here around the fact that if the pace of life, everything's accelerating so much, that change that's happening so quickly and people feeling like it's outside of their control, they can't handle it, that they would turn towards figures that provide them with a sense of like comfort and security and stability. Think about it. Make America great again. Yeah. This idea of going back to the past.
Yes.
It may not be just like, I want to go back to the days of segregation, you know, with like separate drinking fountains.
Right.
It may not be going that far. It may just be like, this is going too fucking fast for me.
Somebody slow this down.
Exactly.
Right. Somebody put me back in my comfort zone somehow.
Yeah.
I get it. I think that's a legitimate perspective. And it is not the one you hear a lot. It gives a little more sensitive to people that might feel that way. Like you can understand, like we evolved, right? We evolved in these tribal bands where change was relatively probably slow. And nowadays, like to expect people to constantly be adapting as fast as we're expecting them to, I think is a little bit absurd.
Yeah.
Well, of course it brings me to a pop culture analysis of this phenomenon you're talking about. You guys, of course, know the great film, The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, hey, that's a great, yeah. great movie.
Well, the character, Brooks Hatlin, he's like the old guy in prison, mm-hmm. and he finally gets paroled.
Right, he was there forever.
Yeah. And he finally gets paroled. He's on the outside now, and he writes a letter back to the prison. So the film is just showing him kind of going about his life. But
And this is set, what, 60s, 50s?
Yes, I think 50s? 60s maybe. Yeah. So you hear his voiceover of the letter where he's saying to the guys still in prison, he's like, "Dear fellas, I can't believe how fast things move on the outside. I saw an automobile once when I was a kid, but now they're everywhere. The world went and got itself in a big damn hurry." And of course, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen that movie, well, go see it and don't listen to this. But he has a serious problem with the world and with depression and kills himself.
Right.
You know, and I think it's a total statement on what you're just describing, Jason. We're not evolved for this pace of change. Mm-hmm. This is a message to all you crazy townies out there. Sometimes Jason, Asher, and I wish you could be here in the room with us when we're riffing on eco-modernist nightmares, the end of capitalism, the collapse of civilization, and lines from Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. Since you can't be here, maybe we could still be in contact in another way. If you've got a comment about the show, or you want to throw some shade at us, or you got a question,
or you have a suggestion of escape route stuff.
Yeah, know? Yeah. Maybe you got a story of your own you want to share. Go over to Apple Podcasts or iTunes and leave us a review and write your comment there. In your comment, include your idea, whatever it is, and we'll think about sharing it in an episode.
How's this? I'll be back. Is that any good?
Oh my God, that's terrible.
You try it. You try it.
Get to the chopper! Okay, listener feedback time. We got this one on iTunes. Came with a 5-star rating. Thanks a lot. Anonymous. The title of it is Comic Relief About the End of the World as We Know It. Like that REM reference.
Great song. Great song.
So this person says, the fundamental value worldview shift, as indigenous peoples refer to it, cannot happen without systematically deconstructing the existing worldview. But that cannot happen without the core foundation of a new worldview in place. They go on to say, I'm not a fan of Heidegger, but that is how he put it. Explain your values and develop your vision for a future. Make it more universal than the counter-cultural values. Do kind of a monkey wrench gang thing. So, I don't know. I kind of agree with that. That's the Buckminster Fuller vision, right? Build a new model that works.
Well, I think they're pointing out just how challenging of a predicament we're in, right? And we talk about this a lot, especially when we're talking about, well, we need an infrastructure change in order to have structural and superstructure change.
Yes.
But we can't have that infrastructure change if we don't change our superstructure and what we see, right?
Yeah.
So it's sort of the paradox that
we can't plan ahead or anything to be proactive. I think the infrastructure is going to change no matter what, right?
Sure.
So that's the dilemma. That's the predicament.
Well, I think so. We're working on the edges, and I think this listener probably agrees that there's. I would hope they would agree there's some worthwhile stuff to do. That sort of.
But what's this have to do with the Hindenburg? What's this have to do with the Hindenburg?
I don't know.
It's not the Hindenburg.
Heidegger.
Heidegger.
Oh, not Heineken?
Not Heineken.
Whatever. Anyway, the one thing that's clear is the egg came first. Thanks for that comment, listener.
Wow.
Okay, so here we are visiting with our good buddy Marvin Harris's Memorial Lens of Doom, taking a look at the world of speedism through that lens. For listeners who aren't as familiar, just a quick summary. You know, this is a view of understanding the world that we inhabit through the lens of infrastructure, which is the physical world, not just the built environment, but all of the physical world structure, which is the rules of society, you know, our laws, our politics, those kinds of things, and the superstructure, which is the belief systems and worldviews that kind of govern the way that we function. And we've talked a lot about how infrastructure, in a sense, drives the others, right?
Yep.
So let's start with infrastructure. And when I think about speedism, I mean, it's obvious, but it's worth just restating. The infrastructure of speedism is a lot of the high dense energy inputs that we've had that allow us to move people and things far distances quickly. That's fossil fuels, primarily the built environment that we built around that. And then when it comes to technology, you know, it's everything from the internet to computer chips and hard drives and mobile devices.
And satellites, you know. And the fiber optic cables and all that.
Now, we experience, as we said before, I think a lot of us experience the pace of acceleration most in the form of technology, but really information technology space and communications. And it could be easy to think that that doesn't really have much physical,
right?
You know, consequence.
The illusion.
But the truth is, all of this stuff comes down to the physical world, the biophysical world, comes with great consequences and limits.
Well, I mean, if you look at the hockey sticks of doom or whatever, we're using more stuff now than ever in the world. Yeah, we haven't dematerialized one bit, even though now we think we have an information economy. It's complete bullshit.
Well, when thinking about the infrastructure of speed, I had a weird thought here. Like, I agree with you. That's the main stuff, the oil, the technology, all that. But I wonder, is there something innate in us, the wiring of a human mind, let's say? Like, do we have an innate desire for speed? The reason this came up for me is I thought about the playground.
Yes.
You know, growing up in school, the fastest kid had the most esteem. Like, when a new kid would come to school, you had to race him against the fastest kid and see, like, does this kid measure up? Maybe this is the new best kid in the school.
Sure, like, who's going to get pick first on the soccer team or whatever, intramural soccer or whatever. I think that's true, actually. I think there's an advantage to being fast or have these sort of skills.
It's probably not just humans. I mean,
evolutionarily, like the tiger can't catch you?
Exactly. But I'm going to broaden this even. And I want you to think about little birds flitting around outside and mammals in general. The whole evolution of the warm-blooded animals, right? And it's happened a couple times, obviously, with happening within the lineage of these birds and the lineage of these mammals. They can be active when the cold-blooded animals, right, like the reptiles and the amphibians, can't be active. They can't be there, or they're active, but they're slow. Like, you ever see how slow a salamander moves, right, compared to a little mouse or whatever that might be the same size?
Yeah, hummingbird, how fast those wings are flapping.
It's incredible. Now, the trade-off is that they need a lot more energy to survive. So there's this positive feedback loop that if you are active because you're warm-blooded, you can hunt more, you can get more resources, but you better get it or you're going to die of starvation. And what I like to think about is if you ever had a pet cat versus a pet iguana, it's about the same size, but the cat will claw your eyes out if you don't feed it. The iguana, you can maybe throw it something once a week and it's fine, you know? So yes, I think there is something there about the pace that animals have and are innate, you know, warm-bloodedness.
Now, you used to keep your cat and your iguana in the same aquarium, right? What would happen?
Well, he's trying to, you know, create a hybrid, but it didn't work, did it?
Well, I think, you know, with fossil fuels, it's analogous to having, like, you know, hot blood, right? It's like you're burning these things and you're just like creating all this power. Yeah. So I think that's what, you know, essentially our society ended up being one that was maybe agrarian in the past that could sort of slow down with the season. You know, there's a harvest period, but then you're quiet and you can maybe go into like a hibernation mode and in the winter and mend your clothes or whatever. And now it's everything all the time, as fast as you can. Yeah. And with
electricity and lights, it's 24/7.
And capitalism, you know, and consumerism, and it reinforces that. It's a requirement, almost like the guy that we're saying that, It's a structure of modernity then that you have to keep going and going and accelerate.
Right. So you're saying like capitalism as a structure.
Yes. In the Marvin Harris sort of perspective, that our modern capitalist society structurally is sort of set up for the speed and acceleration.
Yeah. Well, you remember that slogan that UPS used to have? That's the big delivery company.
What can Brown do for you?
Well, that's even better. I forgot about that one. No, it was moving at the speed of business. Uh-huh. The speed of business.
Yes.
You know, that's the tagline. And yeah, you know, going back to your moving of goods, this is kind of blurring the lines between structure and infrastructure. You know, the structure is we have to move at the speed of business. The infrastructure was like you went from the Pony Express,
right,
you know, up to the U.S. mail service on through to now UPS, FedEx, and then Amazon just whipping around at unbelievable speed.
Right, and a lot of it is just back to the capitalism point. It's competitive advantage. It's one of the ways that companies can differentiate themselves in order to get business, right? And that's why Amazon is looking at doing drone deliveries in urban cities. So you don't have to wait a day. You can get it in an hour.
And they're crushing UPS because they're just wondering what Brown can do for us.
And it's such a philosophical question.
I know. I mean, what ad company came up with that one?
What can Brown do for us? I was thinking about this. This is kind of speculative, but I was wondering if advertising plays like a structural role in speedism. And by that, I mean, like, at least here, the way we've structured advertising, which in some ways kind of supports like a lot of our information infrastructure and industry,
is
like
pays for it.
Yeah, exactly. So
Yeah, I can't wait to hear today's sponsor at the end of the episode. Exactly. Always.
Our entertainment and our news and all these things are largely the business models to be paid for through advertising. But I remember being a kid going to the Netherlands to spend time with family. And the way that they would do things there is that they would run a show complete, you know, like a 20-minute sitcom with no interruptions. But then there's like 10 minutes of ads, you know? And with 10 minutes of ads, you know, maybe you could run a 3-minute ad or a 5-minute ad. You know, you can get a little more in depth, you know. But here in our culture, it's like 30 seconds, 15 seconds.
Do I really want that
seconds.
Toilet paper?
Right. Yeah. They're going to do it like literally, you know, a trial for you.
Yeah. Wipe off.
Yeah. Here, you know, you got to do it in 30 seconds, 15 seconds. Yeah. And I wonder if that kind of like creates this mindset that we all have to be really pithy in our in how we communicate things. The whole idea of an elevator pitch, for example, you know, get to the point right
away. Yeah, speed dating.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, it's interesting. Some big tech like YouTube went in the opposite direction on some level. And they were like, oh, actually, we want to run ads. But the way to run as many ads as possible to keep people on our site for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's when they opened up their videos. They used to have a limit on video length. And then they opened it up. So now Joe Rogan does an 18-hour podcast. You know what I mean? So like...
We thought ours were too long.
Yeah.
Well, okay, that brings us then to the superstructure or the culture and beliefs of speedism. And I think this is pretty simple, honestly. You've already mentioned, Jason, kind of this entitlement that we have around, hey, I want it now. Get it to me instantaneously. But there's a couple of underlying themes, especially with the structures of capitalism and the policies there. And that one is that time is money. Mm-hmm. Everything that happens costs. So you have to boom, 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 get it done. There's also another cultural belief that I see all the time, which is that faster is always better. Well, maybe not in the bedroom, I guess, but you know, certainly in business, certainly in sports, and you know, it's just kind of this notion that speed is always desirable. And it's gotten even to the point where I feel like if things slow down, people wish that time would go away. Like that, oh no, I have to wait for this. I wish I was already there. I wish this was already done. It's like you're willing to have yourself closer to death to not have to slow down.
Yeah. Well, it's the boredom. I think people are scared of boredom.
They're scared of boredom.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I see it with my kids, you know.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Okay, this version of do the opposite is going to be more of a do as I say than as I do, because we have to stay above 50 miles an hour and get this out of the way.
Yes.
So let's do some stories of escaping speedism.
Okay.
And I've talked to you guys before. There was that time when I was coming down to Corvallis from Portland to record podcast episodes, and my car broke down. Mm-hmm. And it basically was taking me all day to get down here, and I freaking loved it.
That's great to hear. I should break your car.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, the slowdown... It was such a weird headspace. I enjoyed the observations that I got, like just looking around at what's going on in the landscape. Of course, it gave me time to judge and criticize everybody around me, as is my...
You enjoyed all the people honking their horns at you, flipping you off, like, why are you going so slow?
Well, it wasn't that. I mean, it was, you know, I was not blocking traffic, but I ended up coming down by bike. I ended up coming down by train. I ended up charging a car for 6 hours while trying to get it recharged. And I don't know. I mean, it really got me to a place where if we all just agreed to slow down a bit, I'm pretty sure we would all enjoy life a lot more.
We'd be okay.
To be honest, I think there's a process though of learning to be more patient. Mm-hmm. If we're a bit acculturated or acclimatized to a certain pace of life and then even with intention, we try to slow down. There's kind of like, I don't know. There's like,
well, cities, people walk faster, right? You know those studies.
Yeah.
Right.
For sure. Yeah. I went through almost like a, and maybe I'm still going through it because who knows what the next chapter will be, gone through this process of moving from a very dynamic community in, and it wasn't a big city, but, you know, living in Silicon Valley and it felt like the culture there was very much a fast pace of life. There's no chit chat at all that happened. Transactions were like this, right?
Uh-huh.
And then we're talking a long time ago. I don't even know what it's like now. People are just walking around with their Oculus glasses and not even looking at each other.
Sure.
And then I moved to Santa Rosa up in Sonoma County a few hours away. And I really felt at that time, like, this is slower. And it was like kind of hard for me to acclimatize to that. I would get sometimes impatient. And then we moved to Corvallis, a smaller town where people really, and I love it about being in Corvallis, people take the time, they actually ask questions and answer them of each other. I mean, yes, you still get the typical American, how are you doing? Fine. How are you? Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But people actually, like when I go to the co-op, you know, people take the time to actually converse and talk to each other. And being in line behind that sometimes,
right,
for me was like,
right.
You know, like it took me a while to sort of get used to it.
This
you know?
Is okay. This is
real. And I think, I mean, you just, I guess, Rob, you just kind of like embraced it right away. But I think we have to be honest. For some of us, it may be a process of being like, okay, I'm choosing this, but I'm like biting my nails.
Well, while you were living in Santa Rosa, or maybe this was, I don't know, I lived in Willits, and that was a lot smaller than Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
And I could tell you, yes, it was. That was a joke my wife and I had, like, oh, I'm going to run down to the store, which is like 3 blocks away. It's like, okay, see you in 2 hours, because you kept talking, you kept running into people you knew all the time. And so it was charming, but it also be frustrating. You had to like explain, like, oh, I got to go.
Yeah.
And that was okay too. But when I was there in Willits, I actually did this thing where I ate all local food, like what I could grow or get for a month for every meal. And I blogged it. You know, I took a picture and explained what I had. And that's the thing. It's the food system since I was a kid to now has really shifted, where so many more people are getting takeout or eating in restaurants, pre-prepared, the whole idea that you don't cook for yourself anymore and anything is available anytime. There's been a huge shift in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And so part of what I was trying to do is consciously grow my own food, source what I couldn't grow myself locally, make my own meals. And I think that's sort of my favorite, do the opposite.
It's definitely a slowdown, but I'm guessing just the appreciation of the quality of the food and the joy of spending your time doing something that's worthwhile.
Yes. I'm kind of sort of think about, like, conceptually how to think about a vision for a better way. And I talked about the cat versus the iguana. Well, there's a famous story, right? The tortoise and the hare.
Hey, another mammal reptile.
Yes. Now that is it. It's a mammal reptile.
Yeah.
And basically, right, the hare is faster and the tortoise is slower. But if you actually look at it from a perspective of efficiency, you would say the hare is time efficient, but the tortoise is energy efficient. They both do the same amount of work. They both complete the race, but one is doing it as a hot-blooded animal burning through fuel fast, and the other is chilling out, going slow, and using much less energy to go the same distance. And so part of what I sort of think about is looking at what is efficient differently. Don't worry so much about the time efficiency. Be in the moment. Enjoy the fact that you're walking slowly and seeing things around you. That's your life. And so that's, I think, be a little bit more reptilian in your life and less mammalian.
I'm sorry to do this, but I'm going to give our listeners a speed time efficiency tip.
Okay.
Don't bother listening to this podcast. Just read Aesop's Fables story and you'll get it all.
You'll get it all.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about this before, but think about travel, right?
Uh-huh.
Setting limits on travel. Mm-hmm. So making choices to travel slow or not to travel at all. I have a friend, Peter, who lives in the UK in Bristol, and he's an avid cyclist and he works on climate and sustainability issues and kind of set a policy for himself of not flying or avoiding it as much as possible. And so when he has to go to continental Europe, you know, for work or whatever, he will take the train. He'll go through the tunnel and it takes him, you know, much longer to make that trip, but he'll bring his bike with him, you know, and he'll combine that trip so that he will get a chance to go up and whether it's into the mountains or somewhere else to get out and to ride. So he's really enjoying the experience and immersing himself.
Well, that's the amazing part is he probably set the rule to avoid emissions, but then he found this is a better way to go anyway. I'm really enjoying the experience.
Yeah.
One of the things that I want to point out on this, how to be more turtle-like, I guess, a few episodes ago, I did a bonus interview with Laura Schmidt of the Good Grief Network, and I was asking her about some things that she does to cope with climate grief. And one of the things she talked about was sort of the idea of cycles in your work and taking breaks and how important it is, especially if you're working on something difficult, to just step back, take some rest, take a break, recharge, give yourself that opportunity. And that is not really a big part of our culture. And I thought that was a really good reminder that, you know, you're probably going to have that long-term sustainability if you're willing to slow down from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of culture, I mean, I think our culture, the American culture, which has been exported out, you know, to other places quite a bit, is known for its brevity. It's not taking its time to get to know you. I mean, there's so many stories of just like cultural disconnect.
Yeah.
You know, when Americans go abroad and, you know, the tradition there is to really take time before you start a meeting or something, you know. And the Dutch have this great tradition. They have a word for this called netafelen. And that is basically a word that they created to describe the act of sitting around the table after a meal and talking. We have no word for this in English, right? And I'm Dutch, but I'm really guilty of like being really like impatient when I eat. I'm just like done and get up. But there's something so lovely about just taking the time, you know, and enjoying a meal and seeing it as an opportunity not only to connect with the food, right?
Yeah.
Ideally, that maybe came locally or you had a role in growing it and cooking it, but the people that you spend your time with.
Yeah, assuming you like them.
Assuming you like them.
That's such, I don't know. When you started talking about the idea of after the meal, you just relax and hang, like it, just, I guess, got a positive feeling. You know, I just feel like, yeah, that'd be great. Why don't we do that? When looking for escape routes for anything, we often look for, well, who are some people out there that we admire that are doing it? And when I was thinking about an escape route from speedism, you know, we talk about quality versus velocity. That I think that's your thing, Jason, with the food, for example. Instead of getting takeout velocity, you're growing your own awesome food and taking the time to cook it. That's quality. And there's one person that came to mind for me is Wendell Berry.
Oh my gosh, of course.
You know, sort of one of the patron saints of our philosophy with Crazy Town. And one of the things that I know that he does is like when he's writing, he just writes it out longhand.
Yes.
Right? And he does that on purpose because it takes time and he's able to get more quality into it. He, even when you hear him speak, his cadence is kind of slow. And you can see that he's got fully formed thoughts coming out of his mouth as he's saying them because he takes his time. And the quality is like, I don't know, sitting around listening to him, I'm just like, wow.
Yeah.
He just said an amazing thing. You know, now I got to take time to even process that. But if he were going at typical cadence, I don't think you'd have the quality.
He'd sound like us.
Right. Well, he would never sound like the blithering idiots that we are.
We're trying to disguise lack of substance and intellect with speed.
To cover it up. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Listeners, please run this podcast at double speed.
Exactly. It will be brilliant. Trust us.
Well, there have been countervailing movements. So it's not just Wendell Berry, but there are actually movements you could look into. And maybe our listeners have heard of these. They're very slow movements. And so there's slow food, right? And I think in Italy, that's sort of one of the places that got started. It spread around the world. And slow money, Woody Tash founded that with some other people. And now there's slow fashion, which I think is great. So these are clothes that really weigh you down.
Right.
Those weight vests,
chain armor,
CrossFit
chain
people use
and stuff. Sure.
That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, speaking of like slow money, for example, I mean, the idea there is that it's like patient capital, right? You're not expecting to get the biggest return as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. You're investing in something that might take time. And, you know, there are examples in our own lives that we could talk about. I think Jason, you and I both invested, our families have invested in local solar projects, you know, where they've asked for upfront investment that gets paid back over time. Mm-hmm. That takes a while. There's another organization here called Seeds for the Soul that was, I remember my family gave them some money and we got it paid back over 4 years, you know, and it wasn't a ton of money and the return was really pretty marginal. Mm-hmm. We're in a position where we had a little bit of money we could throw at it. But they took that money and they invested in putting solar panels on Habitat for Humanity homes for lower income households. And they're able to pay it back through the savings, you know, on their electricity bills. So there are lots of examples of that, even if it's not technically connected with the slow money movement.
Yeah, in that theme, yeah.
You could even think of combining slow food, slow money into one investment in an ecologically sound farm, right?
I mean, sure. Yeah, that's a lot of what you find in the slow money investors actually are really aligned with slow food projects.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. You know, other thoughts about how to do the opposite here. There's deliberative collective decision making. I talked earlier about sort of the rush to judgment before. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, and you look at a lot of indigenous societies and cultures, it's embedded in their cultures that they take time to seek consensus and to grapple with questions. And, you know, I remember, you know, you read stories about interactions between European settlers, for example, coming across, you know, indigenous tribes here, nations in North America, and proposing a treaty, which they usually went, you know, turned their backs on didn't meet. But the time that the local community, the indigenous community would take to deliberate over it would drive them crazy.
Right, you know what I mean? Right.
And there's versions of this that are happening now. Citizens assemblies, for example, and there are lots of models of people doing this all around the world. There are even ones that are doing it around addressing climate. And it's basically opportunities where you're bringing together representative members of whatever community you deem. It could be very local, regional, state, national, to kind of represent the groups who have stakeholder interest in topics. And through an assembly process, you really hash out and kind of tease out what the course of action is, especially with contentious issues that, mm-hmm. that we're dealing with, climate, you know, houselessness, other kinds of issues like that, to be able to come to decision makers, you know, the ones who are actually elected, you know, to make policy or law or whatever it is and govern, with more reasoned, thoughtful process of saying this is what we feel like is best.
Yeah, it reminds me of my experience living in an intentional community, a co-housing community, where you have a fairly manageable size group of people who are trying to make decisions for the community. And you would use consensus decision-making, sometimes sociocracy, and it would be slow. Right. But the idea is that you get a better decision that meets everybody's needs and that has more wisdom built into it. Now, could that be frustrating? Yes. Yes, it could. you know, depending on the topic at hand and how much you care about it or not. But I think in the end, being able to move forward with a community with some wisdom rather than just velocity is what you get.
Well, I remember you talking about this one experience you had there that was really, it took, what was it, 9 months, I think, to deliberate. And that was, which way should the toilet paper be put on the roll?
Right, inside,
you know, inside or outside. And you guys spent, what, months and months deliberating this. Yeah. And you finally came up with the perfect solution nobody thought about, which is just put it on top.
Well, yeah.
We were supposed to be an eco village, so
no
you
toilet just, paper
you
at all.
Use your hands.
Yeah.
That's the solution you came up with.
Yeah.
Great.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard and you want others to consider these issues, then please share Crazy Town with your friends. Hit that share button in your podcast app or just tell them face to face. Maybe you can start some much needed conversations and do some things together to get us out of Crazy Town. Thanks again for listening and sharing.
Discover the art of mindful intimacy with Slow Sex, the latest sensation in our masterclass series. Immerse yourself in the ancient wisdom of tantric practices, now enhanced with cutting-edge scientific insights into the human body. Let global icons Sting and Gwyneth Paltrow guide you through exercises, discussions, and techniques that foster not only physical satisfaction, but also emotional and spiritual harmony with your partner. Conjoin us for Slow Sex. It's time to slow way down. Connect at mineshaft depths and discover the outrageous pleasures of glacial paste intimacy. Oh, sting. Give it to me.
Act fast. Hurry up. Limited time offer.
Crazy town. Da, 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 crazy town.